greatness, Hibbler approached Pat Gibson and demanded $10 owed him so he could buy a rock of crack. When she refused, so the account went, Hibbler pulled out a 9mm handgun and shot her. The Benton Harbor police put Hibbler's name out across the wire, warning that he should be considered armed and dangerous. January 18th posed nothing out of the ordinary for Marv Fiedler. At about 1:30 in the afternoon, he responded to a 911 call. A teenage girl had been accidentally shot in the chest by a boyfriend who was cleaning his .22 caliber pistol. When Fiedler arrived at the home of the victim, he handcuffed the boyfriend and took him back to the station. As Fiedler booked the suspect, near the end of his shift, Alice Palmer, the sister of the murder victim Pat Gibson, called the dispatcher to say she had spotted Tracy Hibbler. He had apparently fled town after the killing, though the Benton Harbor police heard only a few days earlier that he had returned to the area. Palmer reported that Hibbler was walking along the 700 block of Pavone, three blocks from where Gibson had been killed. With only two uniformed officers on duty, and the lone detective tied up on the recent accidental shooting, Fiedler, who ranked as a lieutenant, volunteered to handle the call. In most towns or cities, a police officer would never attempt to arrest a suspected murderer by himself or herself. But here, in Benton Harbor, which could afford only two road officers on duty, the department was left with little choice. Fiedler's partner stayed to process the assault suspect, while Fiedler sped over to Bavone, 10 blocks from the station. The dispatcher passed on a description of Hibbler. She told Fiedler he was wearing a blue jeans jacket with a fur collar, black sweatpants, and a brown hat with a brim. Fiedler was also told that Hibbler wore his hair in braids. When Fiedler got to Pavone, a lone man was standing on the street corner. No, he told Fiedler, he hadn't seen anyone wearing a brimmed hat. Fiedler slowly circled the block, past the boarded-up homes and wrecked-filled lots, when he spotted two men, one of whom was short, dressed in dark clothing and wearing a small brimmed hat, duck into a sickly two-story brown clapboard house. I thought that was Tracy Hibbler, who we had the warrant for, Fiedler later testified. That's who I thought it was. He gave the dispatcher his location and got out of the car at the house the men had entered. After walking up the makeshift front steps, three unpainted 2x4s nailed loosely in place, he knocked on the first floor apartment door. A young boy, maybe 5 or 6 years old, answered. Had he seen two men enter? The boy nodded. Did he know where they went? The boy pointed upstairs. At that point, I told him to go back into the house, Fiedler later testified. He trudged up the dark stairwell, knocked on the second floor apartment. A large, middle-aged woman, Tina, opened the door, which led directly into her spare, tidy kitchen. Where are they? Fiedler asked. No one's here. Fiedler told her of his conversation with the boy downstairs. The taller of the two men quietly walked into the small, crowded kitchen and placed himself behind the neatly set formica table, which took up most of the room and separated him from Fiedler. Do you have any ID? Fiedler asked. The man produced a driver's license attesting to the fact that he was Sam Buchanan. Is there anyone else here? Fiedler inquired, craning his neck to look into the living room. No, no one else here. Another man, much shorter, walked into the kitchen. What's your name? Fiedler asked. Mabin. Fiedler spotted a rusting butcher knife 12 inches long lying on the kitchen table. Tina, it turned out, used it as a security measure, with the blade stuck into a crack in the door frame. The handle acted to barricade the door. I grabbed the knife and either handed it to her or laid it on the top of the stove, Fiedler later testified. But I got it away from in front of him. I believed it was Tracy Hibbler. Can I see your ID? Don't have any, the young man replied. Fiedler clumsily reached with his right hand toward the man he thought was Hibbler so that he could pat his coat pockets for a wallet or possible gun. But before he could reach all the way, the suspect grabbed Fiedler's arm and flung it to the side, momentarily knocking him off balance. As Fiedler tried to regain his footing, the suspect bolted from the kitchen, through the living room, and into the back bedroom. And before Fiedler could even give chase, he heard the shattering of glass. He ran to the bedroom. The suspect had vaulted headfirst through the closed window, landed on the back porch roof, and then dropped 15 feet onto the patchy grass in the backyard. He then sprinted diagonally away from the house toward the muddy, rutted alley. Fiedler had shot his gun only once before while on duty, and that was in his rookie year, when his training officer ordered him to shoot a warning shot as they chased a stolen car. Fiedler testified that he yelled three times for the suspect to halt, and that when the suspect got near the alley between two bare trees, he stopped and turned toward the house and Fiedler. The suspect reached into his back pocket and then raised his hands as he looked up at Fiedler. Fiedler, immediately thinking that the suspect had reached for a gun, reacted so fast that he can't remember whether he held his .38 caliber Smith & Wesson six-shot service revolver with one hand or two. I thought he was going for a gun. I drew my gun and shot three times quick. Fiedler dashed down the stairs, around the house, into the backyard, and knelt by the young man who lay on his back, his arms stretched over his twitching shoulders. A gray-brimmed hat, two quarters, and an orange key ring lay scattered beside him. Blood oozed from a small wound near the left nipple, just to the side of the heart. Fiedler felt for a pulse on the victim's neck. Nothing. A woman who lived nearby walked toward him. "Oh, my God, that's one of the Mabin kids," she said. Fiedler froze, his gaze directed at the still body. "Shit," he muttered. "I shot the wrong kid." He slowly rose and walked toward a nearby tree, kicking at a crumpled beer can in disgust. He pulled out his radio. "I shot somebody," he tersely told the dispatcher. The Preacher. The Reverend Alfred Johnson, pastor of the Union Memorial AME, the oldest and among the most distinguished black churches in the area, recalls with both humor and sadness his first visit to Benton Harbor. It was November of 1988, and he'd driven the 5 hours from Champaign, Illinois, where he had been serving as pastor for 4 years. The regional bishop had asked him to take over the reins at Benton Harbor's Union Memorial, and, being a good Methodist, who had been transferred numerous times before, he was not about to challenge orders. In his 3-year-old Chrysler New Yorker, he sped up I-94, the interstate that runs from Chicago to Detroit, and mistakenly turned off just south of St. Joseph at exit 23. The 5-mile drive from there to downtown St. Joseph is, in places, a magnificent excursion. For the road runs along the ridge of sand dunes, and in the more open spots offers a breathtaking panorama of shimmering Lake Michigan. The Reverend Johnson imagined with some excitement living in an apartment in one of those complexes along the bluff, so he smiled and thought, "Now this is going to be good, living here right off the lake." But as he drove past the pleasant vistas, past the Mansion Grill restaurant, past the Snowflake, a Frank Lloyd Wright-inspired motel, past Monet's, a coffee shop, he got the uneasy feeling that he was, in fact, not in Benton Harbor. This was not as it had been described to him. "And then I had to stop for directions because it was taking me so long," he recalls. "I thought I was in Benton Harbor, but I didn't know. They said, 'No, you gotta follow the road and you'll see the sign.' Well, I saw the sign and I turned. And as I hit the crest of the hill on the bridge, I said, 'Oh, Lord.'" People joke that the Bicentennial Bridge is the longest in the world. I used to grimace whenever I heard that, a remark made more often than not by the people of St. Joseph. But I concede that, though the bridge is only a quarter of a mile long, it joins two landscapes so dissimilar that even after you've made dozens of trips, the view can take your breath away. Traveling across that span was so unsettling that I got into the habit of scheduling interviews each day for only one side of the river. I couldn't manage, not quickly enough anyway, to avoid some resentment and indignation every time I crossed the river. And it had nothing to do with race or political ideology. For each time I hit the crest of the hill on the bridge, I saw what the Reverend Johnson saw, a landscape so shriveled and stooped that it appeared near death. And yet, as I drove cautiously down the ruptured streets, as the smell of burned wood from another house fire wafted through my car window, as I passed the group of unkempt men aimlessly chatting by the downtown soup kitchen, I was reminded that this, for some, was home. As the Reverend Johnson drove over the bridge down the town's 4-lane main street, he saw two car dealerships, one of which has since closed, a vacant motel, the marquee of a boarded-up theater, and several abandoned stores which seemed to have imploded, their innards piled high and some of the debris hanging halfway out of the glassless display windows. It is a city so without resources that when a major street collapsed 2 years before Johnson arrived, the city could afford to fill it in only with dirt. When Johnson left town the next day, he drove back over the Bicentennial from Benton Harbor to St. Joseph, and as he learned, was not greeted by the latter's sprightly downtown. Instead, looming on a hill like a watchtower, sat a concrete fortress, the sheriff's office and jail. Next to it, also built in an august style, was the county courthouse, an imposing square structure. Whether there was intention or not, the building stood as a warning, an admonition to those crossing into St. Joe, don't forget where you are, and don't forget who runs this county. It is that citadel which featured in many of the stories conveyed to the Reverend Johnson by his middle-class congregants during his first months in town. These schoolteachers, factory workers, and city employees, despite their stable position, felt that if there was anywhere they didn't want to be, it was the courthouse. If there was anyone they didn't want to face, it was the police. They told the Reverend Johnson that the whites who ran the courts, all nine circuit and district judges, and all but one prosecutor, were white. And the whites who headed the sheriff's department, the St. Joseph Police, and, for that matter, all the law enforcement agencies, except for Benton Harbor's, did not treat the blacks of the county justly. Johnson was told, for example, of the trial of James Rutter, the recently appointed Benton Harbor School superintendent and a member of the Reverend Johnson's church. A year earlier, Rutter, then the Benton Harbor High School's principal, was returning from the hospital late one night with his 13-year-old stepson, Danny Franklin, and his brother-in-law. Danny had fallen off a moped and had been injured. The three were zipping along in Rutter's Porsche when they were pulled over by Ed Siedenstrang, a Benton Township patrolman. Rutter allegedly had been driving 55 miles per hour, 15 miles over the speed limit. Making matters worse, Rutter, who had been in a rush to get Danny to a doctor, had left his wallet at home. What happened next is in some dispute, but according to Rutter and other witnesses, Siedenstrang whacked him three times with a nightstick on his thigh and then on his wrist, sending his watch into the street. Siedenstrang argued that he was acting in self-defense, since Rutter, a stocky man, had assumed a boxer stance, his fists clenched in front of him. Siedenstrang also claimed that Rutter muttered that the only reason he'd been stopped was because I'm a nigger driving a Porsche. The county prosecutor charged Rutter with resisting arrest. Black leaders picketed the Benton Township Hall, demanding the dismissal of Siedenstrang, who had been accused by others as well, for using excessive force. They also urged the prosecutor to drop the charges. But the case went to trial and might have been forgotten had it not been for the testimony of Louise Wright, a childhood friend of Siedenstrang's. A year earlier, Wright had asked Siedenstrang to accompany her to the Red Arrow Tap, where her estranged husband was drinking. She wanted the keys to their car. When they got to the tap, Wright's husband asked them to wait for him outside. Wright testified, so we, me and Eddie Siedenstrang, agreed to go outside and wait for him. And I said, golly, what brings you down in Benton Harbor of all areas? And he says, ma'am, I'm in uniform. It's coon season. I got this to protect me. He was patting his badge. Siedenstrang then took the stand and had this interchange with Rutter's attorney, Tat Parrish. Parrish asked, did you tell her at the time that the reason you were in Benton Harbor area was, quote, it's just like open coon season, I've got this, and indicating your badge, to protect me? Siedenstrang answered, at no time. Parrish then asked, familiar with the word coon? Siedenstrang, no, I'm not. Parrish, never heard the word coon before? Siedenstrang, yes, I have. Parrish, is it an epithet? Siedenstrang, beg your pardon? Parrish, is it an epithet? Siedenstrang, what? Parrish, is it a derogatory term used toward certain groups or people? Siedenstrang, I don't know. Parrish, you honestly don't know? Siedenstrang, no, I do not. Parrish, you've never heard the term coon used as derogatory to blacks? Siedenstrang, no, I have not. Parrish, never in your life? Siedenstrang, that is correct. Parrish, and you don't even know what it is? Siedenstrang, not to my recollection. Parrish concluded, is it possible you're the only person in the country who doesn't know what that term is? The exchange effectively undermined Siedenstrang's credibility, and an all-white jury acquitted Rutter of resisting arrest, though it did find him guilty of driving without a license and fined him $95. Benton Harbor residents delighted in repeating Siedenstrang's denial that he had ever heard coon used to refer to blacks. So when Marv Fiedler shot Norris Mabin a year and a half after Rutter's trial, The Benton Harbor community was thoroughly prepared to believe that another officer had gone coon hunting. Minutes after the shooting, the Reverend Johnson received a call from a minister whose church was just around the corner from the incident. Johnson, dressed in his gray wool suit, he always wears suits, he says, because you don't want to be mistaken, hurried over. Word had already spread. A cop shot a kid. Shot him in the back. Shot him at point-blank range. Shot him while he was cuffed. Men, women, and children gathered in the rutted alleyway. The crowd rhythmically grew and shrank and grew as people came to see the body of Norris Maben, lying on his back on a miserable patch of grass in the backyard. The questions and declarations floated among the bystanders. Suppositions passed from person to person until repetition made them facts. "Hey, man, who been shot?" "Do dirty." That was Maben's nickname. "You know, Maben." "Hey, if it had been a white guy, he would have run out that door and tried to catch him." "Hey, but he's a black man. A bullet could catch him." "Shot him in the motherfucking back." "What you gonna do?" "Ain't make no sense. He didn't have no gun. Just another nigger to them." For a long while, the crowd directed attacks at Tim O'Brien, the younger, more aggressive officer, who had been the first to arrive at the scene. They assumed he had killed Maben. Some in the crowd half-heartedly hurled sticks and small stones at O'Brien and the dozens of other officers who had come from other towns and townships in the county. Off to the side of the crowd, on the sidewalk, Johnson conferred with the other ministers, his lithe, tall frame towering over the others. Earlier they had approached the police, urging them to remove the body, which they had done. Now, Johnson urged the restless crowd to remain calm. "Go on home," he told them. "You can't do anything. There's nothing else to see. Go on, you're not going to do any good here." Once he realized that the people were not heeding his cajoling or his pleading, he walked through the gathering and asked the gawkers whether they had seen anything. Did Maben have a gun? Was he shot in the chest or the back? Where was the officer when he shot Maben? Johnson and the others did their own informal police work, hoping they could get a quick fix on the situation. "Every police department was there," recalls Johnson, "scouring the community going door to door. Had it all cordoned off. From the early reports, here you have this white policeman from the second floor looking down at this black male and shooting him, running away. He's not a threat. If Maben was white, he wouldn't have shot him. He would have gotten on the radio, and they would have blanketed the area. Stereotypes. Not being comfortable in an area like Pavone. I'm not really sure why he needed to shoot anybody. Nobody who was watching saw Maben with a gun. The only thing they found on Maben was the set of keys." The prosecutor. On the morning of February 8th, 3 weeks after Marv Fiedler killed Norris Maben, Johnson and five other black leaders, including ministers and local NAACP officials, gathered in the office of the county prosecutor, Dennis Wiley. They sat, like schoolchildren, in a semicircle around the cluttered desk as Wiley, looking tired and taut, stood facing them, his hands on the back of his chair, his eyes riveted to the 19-page report lying before him. Johnson listened, his mind drifting momentarily as he admired the postcard-like scene behind Wiley. From where he sat, the Reverend Johnson could see the river and out beyond the lighthouse, ice floes bobbing like corks on the lake. He and the Benton Harbor community had waited, at first patiently and then with irritation, for the prosecutor's determination in the case. And waited, and waited. The days turned to weeks, and in that time a local radio station reported death threats against Benton Harbor police officers. Angry citizens demanded Fiedler's firing. "It was a vicious act of racism," declared one resident at a city commission meeting. Indeed, just a few days after the shooting, recognizing that his reclusiveness and slow pace had only further agitated people, Wiley met with residents at Johnson's church. While promising a thorough and speedy investigation, he had said little about the shooting itself. All that was reported was that Norris Maben had been wanted for driving with a suspended license and with improper registration plates, and that he was not the murder suspect Fiedler thought he was pursuing. So the Reverend Johnson hurried Wiley through the formalities. He wanted to know whether Wiley intended to prosecute Marv Fiedler, though he figured he already knew the answer. Wiley had been an assistant prosecutor for 8 years, until he was appointed prosecutor in 1989, when his predecessor became U.S. attorney. A St. Joseph resident, Wiley is of slight build, his floppy blonde hair, drooping eyes, and bushy mustache give him a kind of hangdog look, as if he had been up all night, night after night. He does work long hours, rarely breaking for lunch. I often saw him jogging in the evenings through downtown St. Joseph and by Silver Beach. He always looks like he's on the last mile of the marathon, said a local attorney. Wiley, friends say, is fanatically committed to his job, and, in particular, is passionate about prosecuting any crime in which a child is the victim. He has 6 children of his own, and can often be seen in his van picking them up or dropping them off at the high school or church. He's not strong. He can't make a decision to save his ass. That view by a local law enforcement officer is shared by many. The common complaint is that he agonizes over decisions, taking too long and often working in near total seclusion from the other community leaders. To his credit and his detriment, Dennis does not consider public perception, says a former assistant prosecutor. He does what he believes to be correct. I never saw anything that I'd consider an impropriety, but there were times the appearance was never addressed. Dennis doesn't have much contact with the Benton Harbor community, that's true. But I